Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two stories on the religion of Islam. Destroying important cultural artifacts in the name of religion is not new. Protestants destroyed statues they considered idolatrous or against their Christian faith in the 16th century. Now, a video is showing members of the Islamic State group destroying ancient treasures in Iraq. The group called the treasures un-Islamic. Ann Ball has more.
Senators spoke out against their actions at a recent hearing on Capitol Hill.
This is not 10-15, this is 2015. And as I speak, people are being crucified. People are being burned alive. They're being beheaded.
Lindsey Graham, a Republican senator from South Carolina, led the hearing on the Islamic State group. Its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, claims to be the caliph of a reestablished medieval Muslim empire that existed hundreds of years ago. Conservative Christian activist Jay Sekulow believes the Islamic claim is authentic or real.
That's what they call themselves. They call themselves the caliphate. Caliph Ibrahim believes he's the leader of worldwide Islam. So whatever we want to call them, in one sense, is irrelevant because that's who they are.
Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are struggling to find the best way to respond to the militant groups. Meanwhile, public figures are debating over whether the Islamic State group should be seen as part of Islam or a deviation from the faith. John Esposito is a professor of Islamic studies at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
From my point of view, what you've got is the hijacking of religion.
Professor Esposito says the militants misunderstand the command in the Quran to kill unbelievers wherever they find them.
When that scripture was uttered, it had nothing to do with Christians and Jews at that point. It had to do with pagan Meccans who were at that point persecuting Muslims. And God in the Quran was saying to them, if they're fighting you, you have a right to fight back.
Some observers say that Islam needs a reformation, like when the Protestants separated from the Catholic Church. They say that such a reformation would reject the traditional understanding of Scripture. But John Esposito warns that these observers should be careful what they wish for. After all, European history has had many conflicts over religious ideas and values.
They'll say Islam needs a reformation. I sometimes say to some of my Muslim friends, what they're really saying then is genocide ought to take place, or close to it, because we think of the Reformation as the Enlightenment, and we forget the Hundred Years' Wars.
Mr. Esposito says throughout time, people have used religion to support political power and warfare. I'm Ann Ball.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA, Learning English. country of Turkey plans to launch an international mosque program that will build mosques across Asia, Africa, and Europe. Observers say Turkey's president wants to establish Turkey as the leader of the Muslim world. But as we hear from Jim Tedder, other countries may also be interested in leading the Islamic world.
Turkey currently is building 18 large Islamic religious centers around the world. The projects include a mosque in Tirana, Albania, which will hold more than 4,000 worshippers. Turkey will also build mosques in the United States, Russia, and Kyrgyzstan. It has similar projects set for the Philippines, the United Kingdom, the Palestinian territories, and Somalia. Observers say President Erdogan's goal is to establish Turkey as leader of the Muslim world. This was the country's position during the Ottoman Empire, which ruled from the 14th century through the early 1900s. Asli Aydintashbaş writes about politics for Turkey's Milliyet newspaper. She says the president cares very much about his historic legacy and his international legacy. She also says he wants Turkey and the world to see him as a person who has advanced the interests of Islam and Muslims. She says this is why he so strongly supports the mosque-building project. Yüksel Taşkın is an expert on politics at Istanbul's Marmara University. He says President Erdogan and his ruling AK party share the goal of returning Turkey to the power of its Ottoman past. Mr. Taşkın says the party is trying to recreate the golden age of Islamic civilization. He says the AKP sees Turks as the leaders of such a rebirth. The Diyanet is the government group that administers the Islamic faith in Turkey. President Erdogan has expanded the group's international office. Supporting religious education is a main element in Turkey's campaign for greater influence over Islam internationally. Turkey has offered financial assistance to foreign students who want to attend its universities. The government also supports international student exchanges. However, Turkey is not the only country interested in leading the Islamic world. Other Muslim countries, especially Saudi Arabia, are also seeking to fill the role. For many years, Saudi Arabia has been spreading its oil money around Islamic countries. Ishtar Gozaydin is a professor of religion and politics at Istanbul's Doğuş University. She says the Balkans is the main region for the competition between Turkey and Saudi Arabia. She says she thinks the two countries once balanced each other in efforts to build mosques and create communities for them. But now, she says, it is more of a competition, especially in Bosnia. Experts say President Erdogan may well be looking to the language of the street to rise above such obstacles. Increasingly, his speeches appear to be aimed at ordinary Muslims in Turkey and around the world. His talks often include a strong anti-Western message. Politics writer Asli Aydintashbaş says the president is behaving as if he already leads the world's Muslims. She says she thinks Mr. Erdogan believes he would be elected leader of the Muslim world if the community could hold such a vote. President Erdogan is increasingly campaigning against what he considers the growing threat of Western Islamophobia, prejudice against or fear of the religion of Islam and Muslims. He is also demanding that the United Nations Security Council create a permanent seat for a Muslim nation. Observers warn that such rhetoric is likely to continue as Turkey's campaign to lead the Islamic world progresses. I'm Jim Tedder.
And that's all the time we have for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Researchers recently completed a study of a new method of giving health care to women in northern Nigeria. They found women and children would use health services more often when they could see a female health worker. Northern Nigeria is a conservative area with a population that is mostly Muslim. Dr. Sally Finley is a professor at Columbia University Medical Center. She co-wrote the report on the study. She said it is unusual for women to work as healthcare providers there.
Most women are not expected to be living on their own, providing healthcare essentially 24/7, or riding around meeting with families in the scattered hamlets.
Nigeria has one of the world's highest death rates of women connected with pregnancy and childbirth. This is called the maternal death rate. The worst rate of maternal death in Nigeria is in the northern region. Male health workers do travel from town to town, but many women patients do not want to talk with a man about their own health care needs. Dr. Finley said the trial study in Jigawa State required that many in the community be involved. It also needed support from religious leaders, even on such matters as transportation for the workers.
We had to get permission from the state imam, the leader of all the Muslims in Jigawa, to have these female-friendly motorcycles and give permission for them to use them.
The program brought women into northern Nigeria as community health extension workers. It seems they were a big success in their community. There were 5 times more visits to the health center after the women health workers arrived than before. Dr. Findlay said the program changed the minds of the women taking part.
Yes, in fact, they did like this, and it did change their understanding of what they could get if they went to the facility for care.
The women of northern Nigeria could get health care at all hours in the local clinic. Mothers got help from women when they had normal births. If a mother giving birth needed more help, the community health extension workers sent her to a hospital. They also gave advice on family planning. Each clinic had 2 health workers. That way, one could go out on home visits, while the other was available to provide services in the clinic. State officials in Jigawa were happy with the positive results of the study. They plan to expand the program of women community health workers. The paper that describes the program by Sally Findlay and her co-authors is published in the journal Global Health, Science and Practice. I'm Jill Robbins. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. After the end of World War I, President Woodrow Wilson sought national support for his idea of a League of Nations. He took his appeal directly to the American people in the summer of 1919. This week in our series, Tony Riggs and Frank Oliver continue the story of Wilson's campaign.
The plan for the League of Nations was part of the peace treaty that ended World War I. By law, the United States Senate would have to vote on the treaty. President Wilson believed the Senate would have to approve it if the American people demanded it. So he went to the people for support. For almost a month, Wilson traveled across America. He stopped in many places to speak about the need for the League of Nations. He said the League was the only hope for world peace. It was the only way to prevent another world war. Wilson's health grew worse during the long journey across the country. He became increasingly weak and suffered from severe headaches. In Wichita, Kansas, he had a small stroke. A blood vessel burst inside his brain. He was forced to return to Washington.
For a few days, President Wilson's condition improved. Then, his wife found him lying unconscious on the floor of his bedroom in the White House. Wilson had lost all feeling in the left side of his body. He was near death. The president's advisors kept his condition secret from almost everyone. They told reporters only that Wilson was suffering from a nervous breakdown. For the next few days, the medical reports from the White House were always the same. They said Mr. Wilson's condition had not changed. People began to wonder, were they being told the truth? Some people began to believe that the president was, in fact, dead. Vice President Thomas Marshall was worried. If the president died or could not govern, then he, Marshall, would become president. But even Vice President Marshall could get no information from Wilson's doctors.
After several weeks, the president seemed to get a little stronger. He was still very weak. He could not work except to sign several bills. This simple act took most of his strength. Wilson's wife, Edith, guarded her husband closely. She alone decided who could see him. She alone decided what information he could receive. All letters and messages to Woodrow Wilson were given first to Edith Wilson. She decided if they were important enough for him to see. Most, she decided, were not. She also prevented members of the cabinet and other government officials from communicating with him directly. Mrs. Wilson's actions made many people suspect that she, not her husband, was governing the country. Some spoke of her as the nation's first woman president.
There was one issue Mrs. Wilson did discuss with her husband, the League of Nations. The Senate was completing debate on the Treaty of Versailles. That was the World War I peace agreement that contained Wilson's plan for the League. It seemed clear the Senate would reject the treaty. Too many senators feared the United States would lose some of its independence and freedom if it joined the League. The leader of Wilson's political party in the Senate, Gilbert Hitchcock, headed the administration campaign to win support for the treaty. He received Mrs. Wilson's permission to visit her husband. Hitchcock told the president the situation was hopeless. He said the Senate would not approve the treaty unless several changes were made to protect American independence. If the president accepted the changes, then the treaty might pass.
Wilson refused. He would accept no compromise. He said the treaty must be approved as written. Senator Hitchcock made one more attempt to get Wilson to reconsider. On the day the Senate planned to vote on the treaty, he went back to the White House. He told Mrs. Wilson that compromise offered the only hope for success. Mrs. Wilson went into the president's room while Hitchcock waited. She asked her husband, "Will you not accept the changes and get this thing settled?" He answered, "I cannot. Better 1,000 times to go down fighting than to surrender to dishonorable compromise."
The Senate voted. Hitchcock's fears proved correct. The treaty was defeated. The defeat ended Wilson's dream of American membership in the League of Nations. Mrs. Wilson gave the news to her husband. He was silent for a long time. Then he said, "I must get well." Woodrow Wilson was extremely sick, yet he was not the kind of man who accepted opposition or defeat easily. From his sickbed, he wrote a letter to the other members of the Democratic Party. He urged them to continue debate on the League of Nations. He said a majority of Americans wanted the treaty approved. Wilson probably was correct about this. Most Americans did approve of membership in the League of Nations. But they also wanted to be sure membership would not restrict American independence.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee agreed to reopen discussion on the treaty. It searched yet again for a compromise. It made new efforts to get Wilson to accept some changes. But, as before, Wilson refused. He was a proud man, and he thought many of the senators were evil men trying to destroy his plan for international peace. Wilson's unwillingness to compromise helped kill the treaty once and for all. The Senate finally voted again, and the treaty was defeated by 7 votes. The treaty was dead. The United States would never enter the League of Nations. And one of the most emotional and personal stories in the making of the American nation had ended.
The long battle over the Treaty of Versailles ended with political defeat for Woodrow Wilson. Yet, history would prove him correct. Wilson had warned time and again during the debate that a terrible war would result if the world did not come together to protect the peace. 20 years later, war came. The First World War had been called the war to end all wars, but it was not, and the Second World War would be far more destructive than the first.
The debate over the Treaty of Versailles was the central issue in American politics during the end of Woodrow Wilson's administration. It also played a major part in the presidential election of 1920. Wilson himself could not be a candidate again. He was much too sick. So the Democratic Party nominated a former governor of Ohio, James Cox. Cox shared Wilson's opinion that the United States should join the League of Nations. He campaigned actively for American membership. The Republican Party chose Senator Warren Harding as its candidate for president. Harding campaigned by promising a return to what he called normal times. He said it was time for America to stop arguing about international events and start thinking about itself again.
The two presidential candidates gave the American people a clear choice in the election of 1920. On one side was Democrat James Cox. He represented the dream of Woodrow Wilson. In this dream, the world would be at peace, and America would be a world leader that would fight for the freedom and human rights of people everywhere. On the other side was Republican Warren Harding. He represented an inward-looking America. It was an America that felt it had sacrificed enough for other people. Now it would deal with its own problems. Warren Harding won the election.
The results of the election shocked and hurt Woodrow Wilson. He could not understand why the people had turned from him and his dream of international unity and peace. But the fact was that America was entering a new period in its history. For a long time, it would turn its energy away from the world beyond its borders. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Tony Riggs and Frank Oliver. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.